And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Kerns, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. It's our Wednesday edition. Well, this hour we're joined by journalist and author Ayal Press, whose latest book is Beautiful Souls, The Courage and Conscience of Ordinary People in Extraordinary Times. What's behind those who find the courage to act on principles and take chances with perhaps one's life? Ayal Press joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome to you, sir.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks, Ayal. It's great to have you. And I just want to say before we start that it's a beautiful book and beautifully written and well-researched. And I really recommend it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'd like to begin with Paul Gruninger, the Swiss police officer in Saint-Gallen, who in 1938, I'll let you tell the story. Can you tell us about him and how you learned of him?
Sure. I actually read about him in passing in a book that just sort of mentioned very briefly that there had been a law passed unanimously in Switzerland in 1938 to bar Jewish refugees from entering the country. This was a problem, perceived to be a problem by the Swiss authorities at the time, because Nazi Germany had just taken over Austria and merged with Austria and terrorized the Jewish population there, most famously in Kristallnacht. And after that, the flow of refugees trying to escape increased dramatically. And the Swiss, of course, were not alone in deciding they would not take in these refugees. But Switzerland indeed passed this very draconian law, and there was a unanimous decision to do so. But there was a police captain named Paul Gruninger in a canton called St. Gallen that bordered Austria at the time. And he went to the conference where this law was passed. He went back to St. Gallen, and he proceeded to defy the law and actually let several hundred, possibly several thousand people in to Switzerland, falsifying their documents, sometimes sending letters to relatives who were stuck in Austria, ordering them to come to his office. And he did this until he was caught and unfortunately suffered very draconian consequences because he disobeyed orders.
Now, you say that he was an ordinary man. He was a law-abiding, risk-averse man, and he was a devoted Swiss patriot. So how do you account for his actions?
Well, that's all true. And actually, I was drawn to Gruninger's story because it seemed such a mystery. I think when I think about the kind of person who would do such a thing, you know, you think of a rebellious type or character type. You think of someone who was maybe very politically outspoken, had a very passionate, ingrained opposition to fascism, and sort of distinguished themselves as a firebrand. Gruninger was none of those things. And I actually went to St. Gallen and met his daughter, Ruth, who is still alive. And it was she who kept saying, you know, he was ordinary. He was normal. There was nothing sort of strange about my father. But so that sort of created the mystery of why did he do it? And in sort of exploring that mystery, I came across some other factors that I think are very important in determining what kind of can lead a person like Gruninger to defy authority and act in the name of principle.
So he had no personal contact with these people before, unlike, say, Schindler, who those were his employees that he knew that he protected.
Well, correct, although actually the issue of personal contact is one of these sort of hidden factors in his story that's very important. Gruninger, as I said, was in charge of a canton bordering Switzerland, and he made what the authorities considered a mistake. The authorities above him, that is, he didn't delegate the task of turning these refugees to someone below him in the chain of command. He actually let them come directly to the police headquarters in St. Gallen. And as a consequence of that, he had face-to-face contact with people who told him, you know, if I'm sent back, my life is at stake. My family's life is at stake. My children's lives are at stake. And as his daughter told me, he simply couldn't bring himself to do otherwise. Now, we know from both history and various experiments, social psychology experiments that have been done, including the famous sort of pseudo-shock experiment done by Stanley Milgram in this country, that when we are distant from the people who are on the receiving end of malevolent orders, we have a very easy time following them. If we don't see them, if we don't hear from them, when they come closer to us, it becomes much harder to follow those orders. And so one of the important things in Gruninger's story, not the only one, but one important factor, is that he got close and he really sort of was pulled in a direction that that you wouldn't assume based on just knowing his sort of record and his beliefs.
Will you talk more about the Milgram experiment, which you put during the Gruninger chapter, and about its known findings and about what it actually said about taking responsibility more than just following orders?
Sure. So the Milgram experiment was conducted by the social psychologist Stanley Milgram decades ago in New Haven, Connecticut. And Milgram took a random sample of people and told them that they were in charge of administering a learning test. And every time the learner got the answer wrong, they would press a button on a shock generator and give the person an electric shock. Now, he assumed, like most people, that very few people would continue shocking when the learner, who was an actor, they weren't told, of course, that this was an actor, but when the learner started screaming, showing discomfort, begging for them to stop, it turned out that 2/3 of the people in this experiment continued shocking the learner all the way to the very end, until basically he acted unconscious. And the, I think, flawed lesson that some have drawn from the Milgram experiment is that people are simply malevolent. They all, you know, we are sheep. We follow orders. If you actually read the transcripts of the of what transpired, you'll see that most of the people in the experiment actually really wanted to stop, and they told Milgram, "Don't you see this guy is suffering?" But Milgram had all kinds of devices built into the experiment to get them to go on. One of those devices was that he put this person in a different room behind glass, and when he redid the experiment, putting that person in the same room with the volunteer, the rate of disobedience doubled. And that just sort of illustrates this point that people, you know, and he observed this himself, people had a very hard time continuing to do it, even in, with that little increase in distance that, that just that, that glass and being in a separate room created.
It's sort of the same thing along the lines of road rage. When we're isolated in our cars, our behavior is much more active than, say, if we had somebody that cut us off in the supermarket with a cart and we were there face-to-face, but when we have the isolation, we can be, you know, flipping the bird and cursing in the car.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that analogy, but it works. I mean, I think that the other thing that Milgram did that was really ingenious in a sort of he was interested in evil and how does it happen. At a certain point, he would tell people, "Look, you're not responsible for what happens to this person. I'm responsible. I run the experiment. You don't. You're just following the orders." And he, you know, this passing along responsibility to someone else was, he realized, a very key mechanism. And again, in Gruninger's case, he could have done that. He could have told himself, "Well, you know, the authorities above me ordered this policy, and I have to implement it." Or he could have just passed it along to the people below him, and then said, when they came, when the record revealed that people had been turned away, "Well, they did it. I didn't do it." But this contact with the refugees was one of the factors that I think really triggered him.
And then he lost his job, and I just want you to continue with the story. And then he was finally recognized. Will you just finish so our listeners will know that eventually he was recognized for his righteousness?
Although it took a good long while. Indeed, he lost his job. He was actually subjected to psychological exams to see if he might be deranged. And then, as I discovered, he had trouble making a living. He couldn't find steady work. He was disgraced. He wasn't just fired. He was disgraced. And there were rumors that he had, in fact, been collaborating with the Nazis, that he had let people in for money or for sexual favors. It took until 1994 for the Swiss government to acknowledge that none of this was true. 55 years after he had done this, there finally came an official acknowledgement. And, you know, I tried to tease out, well, why is that? I mean, it's not like in Switzerland in the 70s and 80s, people thought, oh, it was a great thing that we barred Jewish refugees. Surely that wasn't the case. And then, of course, the answer became obvious, and it came up in other stories as well. The problem with recognizing what Gruninger did as right is that it then calls into question why there weren't more people like him. Mm-hmm. Why didn't anyone else do the same thing? So he became a kind of symbol of reproach for everyone else once he was recognized.
Which is one of the problems with people who step forward or who defy the rules.
That's right. And I think that we have a mistaken notion that we only feel uncomfortable about these people when we disagree with what they're doing. Right, the person, the sort of person who thinks they're a man of principle but is actually a zealot. When we clearly disagree with what they're doing, well, then we think we don't like them. I think we actually are discomforted almost as much when we do agree with what someone like a Gruninger is doing, because it then calls into question what we ourselves are doing. If we do agree with them, why aren't we taking the same chance?
We're speaking with Eyal Press. He's a journalist and author. His latest book is Beautiful Souls, The Courage and Conscience of Ordinary People in Extraordinary Times on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and A.L. Press. We're talking about his book, Beautiful Souls, The Courage and Conscience of Ordinary People in Extraordinary Times. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. That number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Perhaps you have a story of courage and conscience to relate.
So, Eyal, let's move on to Alexander. Is it Jevtich?
Jevtich.
So he was taken prisoner by the Serbs when they captured this Croatian city of Vukovar.
Yes.
And correct. Taken to a Serbian prison camp occupied mostly by Croats. Tell us what he did.
Well, as I describe in that in the chapter about Jevtich, whose nickname is Acho, and I continue to think of him as Acho.
Right.
So he was taken to this prison camp, as you say, and the Serbian guards in the camp gathered all the men in this town once Vukovar had fallen into Serbia's hands, and this was in the middle of the war between Serbia and Croatia, a vicious war and with terrible consequences, leveling cities and so forth. Yet the guards had a problem, which is that they knew that some of the people who had been rounded up and taken to the camp were Serbs, were their fellow ethnic Serbs, but they couldn't identify them because Serbs and Croats speak the same language. They also look a lot alike. And so what to do? Well, one of the guards recognizes this guy, Acho, sitting among the prisoners. He says, oh, you know, they had served together in the Yugoslav National Army. So he says, you know, hey, we know each other. We need your help. Among these prisoners, pick out the Serbs for us so that we can take them to a separate room. Understood that in that separate room, the prisoners there would be treated well compared to those in the rest of the camp who were being beaten and sometimes taken outside and never heard from again. So Acho agrees. He gets up and he starts calling people by Serbian names and kicking at their feet and so forth. The people he's calling look at him in a bewildered way at first because they're not actually Serbs, they're Croats, and he is inventing their names. That's the one sort of distinguishing feature that could tell people apart. He's calling them by Serbian names, and these Croats start getting what he's doing, and then gradually this room fills up with Croats, who he basically saved from who knows what.
Now, you say he wasn't driven by some greater sense of injustice, but by a base emotional impulse at that moment to do the right thing, which was a great thing. But do you wonder if he regretted his actions or if he would have repeated them given another situation?
That's a really good question. I think he definitely – that's what he told me. He didn't think too much. He did what came impulsively to him, and what came impulsively to him was I need to help the people here because they are, like me, terrified, helpless, and defenseless. I think that you raise and I sort of use his story to explore the very interesting science around moral impulses, that sometimes we indeed feel an impulse to help someone that if we thought about it too much, maybe we wouldn't do it. We'd start calculating.
Is there any research on those who were meek, even cowardly, until they come across something that makes them very resolute and determined to right or wrong?
Well, there is in the literature that I read, and I talk a little bit about this on people who saved or acted to rescue Jews during the Holocaust. There were these spontaneous moments, these sort of encounters that people sometimes had. I tell the story of one guy who was a fascist, an Italian fascist, supporter of Mussolini, and he saw a Nazi beating a boy for no reason, and it just changed him. And then after that, he switched. Now Acho didn't have that kind of encounter, but he knew exactly what he felt at that moment. What he felt was, I need to help these people. Now, in terms of would he have done differently in another moment, you know, I do say in the chapter that, you know, the war raged on. I mean, this was 1991, and in 1992, Serbia is basically committing acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing in neighboring Bosnia. Now, Acho was not one of the people who stood on street corners saying, this is wrong, we have to stop this war. So sometimes these, you know, he really did act in the moment, and after that kind of stopped acting. And so we have to acknowledge that and not think that these people are saints, the people I'm writing about.
Well, in fact, you were quite surprised when you met him. Tell us what he was like and why you were so surprised.
Well, I have to say I thought I would be meeting one of those sort of anti-war types who I'd read about during the Balkan Wars. I assumed he would have had an apartment lined with books and pamphlets and all kinds of justifications and explanations for why the ethnic cleansing and the wars that took place in the Balkans were wrong. His apartment didn't have a single book in it. Did have a large television in it, which he enjoyed watching. Acho told me he did not finish high school. He was in many ways a very, you know, just an ordinary Joe. But he nevertheless acted in a way that was extraordinary. And so there are certainly lessons to be derived from his experience. I should say his. There were other things that I discovered led him to do what he did, and a very important part of his story was his upbringing and his parents.
Well, yes, go on.
Well, I discovered, you know, again, thinking, okay, but there's got to be something else. It couldn't have just been instinct. Certainly instincts can sometimes lead people to do right, but also sometimes to do terrible things. Acho then told me that the story of his mother, who was a Holocaust survivor. There was a Croatian concentration camp in Croatia. The Croatians during World War II, it was a fascist regime whose brutality shocked even some of the Nazis. And the victims in that camp, many of them, were Serbs, including Acho's mother, who lost both her parents. She became a war orphan. Now, you would think, here's a guy raised by a Serbian mother who's been victimized by Croats. So surely she will teach him that he cannot trust Croats and he should always act only in the name of his Serbian identity. She taught him the opposite. She taught him, don't pay attention to these ethnic labels. That is what got your parents, your grandparents, who you never met, killed. the sort of decision to decide that a person's worth is judged by their ethnic identity or label. And so it's a story of extraordinary refusal on her part that preceded his.
Right. I mean, she was extraordinary.
Where does religion stand in this as a motivator for selflessness and extreme courage?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Acho is a proud atheist, raised in Yugoslavia, actually raised in a communist household, you know, at the time Yugoslavia was a kind of authoritarian country with a communist leadership. His parents seemed to accept that. He was an atheist, and yet he acted with extraordinary moral courage. So, you know, his story does at least tell us that religion is not a prerequisite for such acts. Now, there are certainly cases where, and I describe one earlier in the book of a Portuguese diplomat who gave visas to Jews during World War II, who said he was motivated by his faith in God. And I think that the very notion of conscience, you know, in a sense, has become complicated by the pluralistic age that we live in. It used to be, you know, centuries ago, if conscience motivated you, it was assumed you were talking to God. Nowadays, I think we just assume, rightly, I think, that people are talking to themselves. They are looking inside themselves and having an inner dialogue, in a sense.
So I was thinking about anti-abortion demonstrators who use religion as their reason for violence.
Well, that is a very good example in my mind of, first of all, how, you know, one person's act of conscience can be another person's act of recklessness or lawbreaking or terrorism. And I do talk in the book, I think it's a very important part of any discussion of conscience, that that we recognize that there is an aspect of absolutism to it. There is this sort of unbending quality. I will not be swayed, and I don't care what the laws say, and I don't care what my fellow citizens think. That can be an incredibly admirable impulse. It can also be a very dangerous impulse. So I try to grapple with that a little bit in the book, not to kind of paint a rosy picture.
I don't remember where I heard it, but isn't there a situation on that subject regarding your father that was the seed for this book for you?
In some sense, yes. My father was physician in Buffalo, New York, and I wrote about him in my first book, Absolute Convictions, and part of his medical practice involved providing abortions in the city of Buffalo, which he viewed as a legal medical procedure that he had an obligation to provide. And in Buffalo, New York, where I grew up, enormous opposition and protests erupted, targeting him and other physicians. So that was, in a sense, the seed in that I'm very interested in how, you know, what leads people to stand by their principles when it doesn't seem obvious they will. And certainly my father would not have been an obvious person to continue remaining a provider as he did. He was not a feminist. He didn't really know much about the abortion politics. He just felt this is part of my medical professional duty. And then he became more and more committed.
Hmm. We're speaking with Eyal Press, journalist and author. The name of the book, Beautiful Souls. It's Topical Kearns. Let's take another break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Kearns. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper and with Eyal Press, journalist and author. The name of his book, Beautiful Souls, The Courage and Conscience of Ordinary People in Extraordinary Times. Eyal, I wanted to ask you, just as an aside, I noticed that the subtitle of your book before was Saying No, Breaking Ranks and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Why did you change it?
That's a good question. It was a decision. The book just came out in paperback. And the paperback publisher suggested a slightly different title. I liked it. A subtitle, that is. I liked it. I also liked the original. And I should say, you know, maybe because the book has been out a while, I feel less of an obligation to explain the breaking ranks part in the subtitle. When people hear the phrase "beautiful souls," this was actually one of my fears. They may think, well, this is just you know, a set of stories that have a kind of honey syrupy sappy quality. It's about goodness. As I hope they will realize when they open the book, the term "beautiful souls" is actually a very charged and contested one. It's an Israeli Hebrew phrase, yafeh nefesh, and in Israel, people who are known as beautiful souls, as yafeh nefesh, are often thought of in a way as bleeding hearts, as people who are too soft. And this is, in a sense, a term of derision used to describe soldiers in the Israeli army who aren't tough enough to do the dirty work, in a sense. And this often comes up when missions take place in the occupied territories. So I called the book "Beautiful Souls" because I wanted to get across right away, and I do discuss this early in the book, that we have, you know, we shouldn't think of syrupy stories in which everybody agrees, and this is just, you know, these kinds of acts are welcome. They're often very unwelcome, both in democratic societies and, of course, in undemocratic ones. The original subtitle was sort of giving the reader a clue to that, talking about, you know, breaking ranks and defying authority. I hope that, you know, readers of the paperback will not need that cue and yet will be intrigued by the book.
I see. Well, speaking of occupied territories and the Israeli army, should we move on to Avner Wishnitzer?
Sure.
So tell us about him and his moral dilemma.
Sure. So Avner Wishnitzer was an Israeli soldier in a unit called Sayeret Matkal. He grew up on a kibbutz, dreaming of serving in a top unit of the Israeli army at a time when in Israel the sort of children of the kibbutzim were known to be the best soldiers. But he feared he would never get to do this because he was skinny, he wasn't strong enough. Then he sort of toughened up during his adolescence. He discovered taekwondo, which is his great love, and he became actually a national champion. And he entered the top unit of the army, Sayeret Matkal. He served in that unit for 3.5 years. But then afterwards, he had a crisis of conscience, a sort of gradual awakening as he made trips unexpectedly. He was invited to a lecture where he saw images in the occupied territories of Palestinian farmers being mistreated. And he didn't initially know what to make of this. He sort of was just bothered, but he was sufficiently bothered that he went to this area of the West Bank, where these the alleged mistreatment had taken place, and for the first time had conversations with Palestinians, and he was shocked, and he was troubled, and he became so troubled that eventually he told the commander of his unit that he would no longer serve on any mission in the occupied territories, and in Israel he became what is known as a refusnik. Someone who doesn't, he's not a pacifist. He wanted to continue and indeed did continue serving in the army, but he was kicked out of his unit and he wouldn't serve in these particular missions.
And it was great disappointment for him because of the way he had put the Israeli defense forces on a pedestal his whole life and becoming a part of it.
That's right. And that's actually one of the running themes of the book. Avner grew up deeply patriotic and actually, he remains deeply patriotic. He is a very proud citizen who believed of Israel, who believed very much in the ideals of the army, the belief that that this was the most moral army in the world. He really took this to heart. And because he took it to heart, when he saw what was happening in the occupied territories and saw that the army was, in a sense, enabling it in his eyes. He couldn't square those two things. And the thing about both Avner and the other characters in the book, you mentioned that Paul Gruninger was a Swiss patriot. Well, both of them were these kind of loyal idealists. They believed very deeply in the sort of underlying principles of their nation. But when they saw those principles being tarnished or abandoned, they couldn't go along with it. And so these characters are in a sense, not rebellious outsiders. They are true believers.
Now, was he ostracized? Was he isolated when he became a refusenik, or was he one of many?
Well, he was both. He was ostracized. And actually, just to offer people a sense of what in a sense, the difficulty of acting against one's prior beliefs, in his case, or one's society, one's fellow citizens. Avner told me that he didn't describe details. He couldn't describe details. But he told me that he made it clear that in his time in the army, he participated on many risky missions, some of which, were risking his life for his country. He said that refusing and coming forward to his commander and saying, "I won't serve in these in the territories," was 10 times harder. That's what he said, 10 times harder. And he described the feeling as the same feeling he had when he first jumped out of an airplane learning to parachute. He said, except it lasted longer. He was he felt utterly alone. He felt like he had no idea what just happened. He went overnight when a story was published about what was happening and mentioned his name. He went from being this sort of symbol of patriotic duty to being a traitor, and it really sent him reeling. He could not deal with it. He told me he couldn't read the papers. He couldn't go on the internet. He just, because there were all kinds of things being written about him and so forth. Now, you asked, did he do this alone? Actually, there were a couple of other soldiers in his unit who also did this. They actually came forward together, and yet it was this difficult. So you can imagine how difficult this is.
So that sense of isolation for these nonconformists, it seems to pervade, you know, being one of these people who actually does stand up. I think, is that a big part of what they go through?
Definitely. I think that part of the message, I suppose, of the book is that people who stand up for their principles often end up feeling extremely alone and unheard. And in a sense, that opens up the question of responsibility to everyone else. Because it's surely the case that people who act in this way are going to be the minority. It's not going to. We will never have a society where everybody blows the whistle, or even the majority do. The very nature of institutions, we know most people will go along. But the question is, when someone doesn't, what do you do? What if it's your neighbor? What if it's your coworker? What if it's your classmate or your fellow administrator? Then I think you have a different question, which is, do I listen or do I label this person? Do I dismiss them as, a rat? Or do I say, wait a minute, if this person's blowing the whistle, maybe something really wrong is going on? And I hope that reading this book triggers those kinds of questions in people.
How about the recent, seems to be there's crackdowns on whistleblowers, say, in corporate America. What are your views on that?
I think that the crackdown, there's also been a crackdown on whistleblowers in the national security arena under Obama. And I think in both the corporate arena and the national security arena, it's certainly the case that sometimes people blow the whistle for the wrong reasons, that they blow the whistle because they imagine or that they're paranoid or they see something that's not really there. That's obviously true. On the other hand, we've just lived through an era where we fought a war on the basis of false assertions made by our leaders about weapons of mass destruction, where we witnessed a financial implosion that included rampant fraud, where people were sold and bought things that were worthless. And as we're learning afterwards, in many of these cases, and I describe one of these cases in my book, in many of the cases there were insiders who spoke out, but nobody listened to them. So to be cracking down on whistleblowers in the aftermath of that, I think is exactly the wrong direction. These people who take enormous risks acting in their own principles often don't benefit themselves, ironically, but they do benefit society. If we listen to them, you know, if someone had said, wait a minute, Madoff, there's a Ponzi scheme here, and indeed there was someone trying to say it's a Ponzi scheme, if someone had listened earlier.
We're going to get to Leila Wildler, but before we do, I just want to ask you where Avner Wishnitzer is today and what he's doing.
He is in Israel, and I am still in touch with him. And he, unlike Alexander Yevtich, the Serb I described, Avner's act of conscience and his awakening triggered something deeper, a real longer commitment to the principles of peace and reconciliation. He actually has he's one of the co-founders of an organization called Combatants for Peace, and these are Israelis and Palestinians, former fighters, former combatants, who have put their guns down in the name of reconciliation and ending the occupation. And so he did not stop with that one act. And I told his story in a sense because I think it varies. You know, sometimes an act of conscience can be singular, and sometimes it can really trigger a much deeper and longer commitment.
We're speaking with journalist and author Eyal Press. The name of the book is Beautiful Souls. Taking a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with Eyal Press. His latest book is Beautiful Souls. How about a website where people can learn more about you and your numerous books?
They can go to www.eyalpress, that's EYALPRESS.com, and learn about my books and some of the other things I've written.
Is there a difference between acts of courage and conscience when some are knee-jerk and others have been considered and thought about for a long time? Reading your book, it reminded me in 1980, the Miami riots were stories of really courageous black Liberty City residents who took in white motorists when they were under attack and sheltering them in their homes. But if it's something knee-jerk versus that's been a long time considered, what's the difference there?
I think there is a difference, and I think that in a sense, what I take away from the various stories in the book is that that spontaneous act, always admirable, always in some ways, sometimes miraculously so, doesn't necessarily signal that the person will continue acting in accordance with that same impulse, but sometimes it will. And so I think that the slower awakening, and there are a couple of characters in the book, Avner is one of them, who do what they do after really thinking about it and really wrestling with it. And I think when that happens, it's much more likely to trigger a basic change in, commitments and loyalties and priorities over the course of a life.
Do you believe that human beings generally have an inner voice that tells them the right thing to do, which is at odds with another voice that's more concerned with their survival in many cases, because you risk so much by speaking up or by defying orders? But do you think that at the heart of it, most human beings have an inner voice that tells them the right thing to do?
I'm not sure I would put it that way. I think what we all have, what all of the people in the book that I wrote about have, is the power to empathize. This is a book really about the moral imagination, which is not a phrase I invented. It was used by Adam Smith, the economist, actually, in a famous book he wrote called The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And Smith said, what is it about us that makes us uncomfortable when we see our brother being tortured on the rack. This is how he put it. And he said, you know, even the greatest ruffian feels this discomfort. What is that? And he said, well, it's because we have sympathy. We have this ability to put ourselves in the shoes of that person. Now, I think we all have that ability. We also have mechanisms to shut it down or to distort it so that we only sympathize with people who look like us or who have our skin color or our religion. And that, I think, is very dangerous. So it takes tremendous work to keep one's imaginative sympathy and one's moral imagination broad enough to perform acts like these.
In all of the characters in your book, and I feel funny calling them characters because they're people, and
yes,
they're real people, all of whom you met except for Gruninger. I guess, when did he die?
He died in 1972.
But you
so
met
yes,
his daughter.
I met his daughter.
Yeah.
Yes.
But one of the themes is that it's easier to follow and obey these cruel orders proportionate to the distance from the consequences when one doesn't come face to face with the victims or hear their screams. So what does that say? I mean, I know there were, I mean, from the Milgram experiment to other studies that you cite. So do we have to see it in order to empathize with it? Or
I think it helps, you know, and I think that that's one of the real conundrums and problems in the world we live in. We have so many layers of distraction. We actually see a lot. I mean, compared to people, you know, 100 years ago, we're seeing images all the time. You can go on the internet and you want to find out what things look like in a part of India that you've never traveled to. You can find out. But we're so distracted and we have so much of these images that I think they all kind of blur together. We don't stop and look. And I do think that if we don't do that, if we don't pause and kind of consider the human element in the particulars of some tragic event we're reading about, we're liable to kind of gloss it over.
So we only have about 4 minutes left, and we have Leila Wiedler, and we have the really poignant story of Daryl Vanderveld, which there were so many incredible quotes from him. And so which would you like to talk about if we don't have time for both?
Well, maybe I'll talk a little bit about Leila, just because I've been talking only about men so far. And
okay.
I want to make clear that this is not a male trait. Leila Wiedler was a whistleblower who displayed, I think, extraordinary moral courage. She blew the whistle in 2003 on the financial fraud at Stanford, the firm based in Houston, that ended up perpetrating the second largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history, a $7 billion Ponzi scheme. She lost her job. She was ostracized. And she was then called by the government 5 or 6 years after she blew the whistle, alerting them to this with documents and so forth. Someone called her and said, "We'd like to talk to you about a former employer of yours." And, you know, she sort of grimaced because finally someone was listening. So I tell Leila's story because I want readers of the book not to imagine that, you know, you only face these dilemmas in Rwanda or in Nazi Germany. We face them here, and all of us do, in small and sometimes large ways. Leila's story, I think, brings that across.
And did any good eventually come from her actions? She was notified, so what happened?
Well,
she was
contacted.
A little
hard to... Yes, she was notified, but, you know, it was too late by that point. Good came in the sense that Leila was eventually called to a field hearing in Louisiana, a state where many Stanford's investors, defrauded investors, live. She went to this hearing, and she appeared in the eyes of those defrauded investors as a hero. And finally got a sense that, wow, look, these are real people who held this money, who lost it, and I acted on their behalf. Those people saw that there were people on the inside who could have done it differently. And so I think there's good in sort of reflecting on that, but there's not much good in what the SEC did, which is ignore her, and there certainly isn't good in the lesson of, you know, financial fraud occurring when people sort of stop thinking that there are lives at stake and there's livelihoods.
You have a quote in the book from Ralph Nader: "Whistleblowers are born, not made. They are a breed apart." I guess do you agree with that?
I don't actually. I don't fully agree with it. He, you know, there may be some truth to that. But, you know, I don't think Layla was the last person who would have thought of herself as a whistleblower. And she was a very loyal, proud financial broker. But she saw it being done wrong. And so what she did was her job, which was due diligence and looking out for her clients. Unfortunately, that was not the standard at Stanford. It also wasn't the standard throughout Wall Street, as we know, when we are now reading about, you know, the kinds of worthless products that were cut up and resold, and people profited from that. So I don't think she was born that way, but I think there definitely is something in all of us that can enable us to do the kind of thing she did.
Once again, the website where people can learn more about you and your books?
It's www.eyalpress.com.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. Eyal Press is the author of Beautiful Souls, The Courage and Conscience of Ordinary People in Extraordinary Times. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Eyal.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Tomorrow's program begins with social psychologist Sam Summers, author of Situations Matter, Understanding How Context Transforms Your World. Also, Linda Gastenheimer's Food and Dining with wine columnist Fred Tasker. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and other programs at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information, discussion, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like, if you would, so your friends can find us too. And to the calendar, on this day in 1905, 108 years ago, new Florida Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward gives his inaugural address and lays out the plan for drainage of the Everglades. Later in the year, the legislature passed drainage laws. The new river was the first dredge. And on this day in 1924, 89 years ago, the birth of actor Marlon Brando in Omaha, Nebraska. Brando's mother helped begin the career of Henry Fonda. And one more before we sing I'm Walkin'. On this day in 1930, 83 years ago, the birth of Florida's U.S. Senator and Governor Lawton Childs in Lakeland. In his 1970 Senate campaign, he trod from Pensacola to Key West. So we leave with a thought from Marlon Brando, whose first screen role was a bitter, crippled veteran in 1950's The Men. Quote, acting is the expression of a neurotic impulse. It's a bum's life. The principal benefit acting has afforded me is the money to pay for my psychoanalysis. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Next, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.